Do you know someone who can benefit from this radio program? You can find the complete archives of this show and hundreds of others at naturalnewsradio.com. Just send your friend that link, naturalnewsradio.com, where they will find truly amazing interviews and information that simply isn't published anywhere else. In the Natural News Radio archives, you'll find interviews with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Senator Rand Paul, Governor Jesse Ventura, Suzanne Summers, alternative cancer doctors, nutrition experts, preparedness experts, and a wealth of others. And it's all free. Listen in real time at naturalnewsradio.com or download the MP3 archive files anytime you want to listen on your phone, mobile devices, or personal computer. When you want articles on these topics, check out naturalnews.com with over 35,000 article pages on nutrition, natural cures, health freedom, and much more. It's all part of the Natural News Network. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. In uncertain times, you need gear you can count on. That's why I teamed up with Daniel Vitalis to launch SupplySource.com. It's a new online retailer offering extremely durable gear for emergency preparedness and long-term survival. Everything we offer survives my daily use test on a ranch in Texas, plus Daniel's outdoor endurance test in the rugged wilderness of Maine. Most of the stuff we test ends up in a pile of trash because it breaks. The stuff that doesn't break, we stock it on SupplySource.com. To get the site started, we've launched it with a line of rugged, reliable, waterproof LED flashlights, now chosen by military and law enforcement everywhere. And we'll soon be adding a whole new brand of emergency water filters, family defense gear, and urban survival tools. When you want your gear to really work, get it from SupplySource.com. Have you ever wanted to learn where you can get free food and medicine from the plants growing around your neighborhood? Or how to turn your own backyard into a food production center? Or even how to reverse cancers using the latest groundbreaking research in alternative cancer therapies? You can learn all this and more from webseed.com. It's sort of like Netflix, but it's for documentaries and how-to courses on natural health, food production, self-reliance, and other life-saving topics. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and I created WebSeed so that listeners like you could get instant streaming access to truly groundbreaking instructional courses. Our new program called Vaccines Armed and Dangerous exposes the total fraud of modern vaccine quackery, and our Survival course teaches emergency preparedness, including skills like how to build your own emergency water filter. Explore over 100 valuable courses and documentaries right now at WebSeed.com.
Welcome to the Health Ranger Report with your host, Mike Adams.
Hello, everyone. Welcome. This is Mike Adams, the Health Ranger with NaturalNews.com. Today, we are joined by a very special guest, one of the people that I have long admired as a man of courage, a man of principle, a man who has helped educate literally millions of people, not just about health freedom, but about important financial issues. He's known as Ed Griffin, and he is the creator of Reality Zone. And we'll put that web information out for you here during this interview, but I want to welcome Ed. Thanks for joining me today.
Well, thanks, Mike. It's a real pleasure to be on your show.
Hey, the pleasure is all mine. Like I said, I've been a longtime admirer of yours. I'm a member of your Freedom Force team of patriots and revolutionaries, I suppose. How do you describe the team?
That's an ongoing problem, Mike. I just call them very smart people, understand what the world is really about, and we refer to ourselves as the network, the Freedom Network.
There we go.
But anyway, yeah, as you know, our name is Freedom Force. That's another good way to describe it. It is a force. We have fun playing with the line, you know, may the force be with you. Well, that's the Freedom Force, and we're serious about it. We do feel that we're on the side of light against darkness, and so there's a lot of parallels there.
Well, speaking of darkness, let's talk about the stock market and the money system. A lot is happening right now. We've just recently experienced the fabricated debt ceiling crisis and the fabricated solution, if you can call it that, S&P downgrades. Can you give us a hint at, people are confused, Ed, so what does all of this mean? Lay it out for folks.
Well, okay, lay it out. What does it mean? It's really much simpler than you might guess. It means that we're in the hands of our enemy. It means that the people who are making these big decisions regarding the future of our economy, which is another way of saying regarding the future of our country, they are all of one mindset. They believe that the proper way to run an economy or a nation is to do it from the top down with firm rules and regulations and directivities. You know, people at the top who have absolute dictatorial power to make things happen. They believe in a command economy. They believe in collectivism, in other words. And when you realize that this is their mindset, then you understand exactly what they're going to do, because they only have one trick. And that trick is to completely manipulate the market. They've already killed the free market, although a lot of people give lip service to it and say, you know, if we don't do something, first thing you know, capitalism would be damaged, or the free market would be dead. Well, this happened a long time ago.
Right.
Anyway, the point is that we know what their trick is. Their trick is to create more money out of nothing and push it into the economy, and of course push it through the channels which they control, the ones where they have influence. And it's very much to their advantage to do that. It gives them great power and wealth over the system. But the net effect on the nation and on the people is devastating, because it keeps expanding the money supply, and that means that the purchasing power of the monetary unit, each dollar, goes down, down, down. Every time they put another billion or trillion dollars for so-called stimulus or whatever they want to call it, a bailout or some other name, a quantitative easing, they have all these nice little names for it. All it means is that they're creating money out of nothing and pushing it into the economy through their cronies.
Well, yeah, we've lost, what, 97% of the value of the dollar since the Fed was created in 1913?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. If we'd had a dollar in those days, 1913, it buys about 3 cents worth of product today. And that process actually continues. It's accelerating. And the point of all that is that where does that end? You know, this does have an end, and nobody seems to think it has an ending. Well, it ends when you've got 3% left. You've not much further to go before you've got zero left.
Right. And they're going after the last few pennies.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we're absolutely approaching the point of the Zimbabwean experience and the German experience, Argentina's experience, where the value of the monetary system just essentially goes to zero. And at that point, the economy collapses. There's a complete reshuffling. There's violence. There's civil disorder. There's a lot of misery. People lose their wealth. It's a complete reshuffling of the deck.
Now,
it's a horrible situation.
It's important to note that this is not just theory or conjecture. This is actually, and you're taking this from the historical record, this has happened over and over again throughout human history, nation after nation following the exact same pattern. So the U.S. is headed in the same direction because it fits the same pattern, right?
Well, absolutely. There's no question. This is not conjecture. We just know how it works. It's, 1 + 1 = 2. It's as simple as that. The only difference, really, Mike, and you know this very well, is that the United States has had a free ride for a long time. If we had just been one more country in this historical overview, the economy really would have collapsed long ago, I think. But the fact is that ever since the end of World War II, after the Bretton Woods Conference, the United States dollar was given a very special status. It was made the world reserve currency, as they like to call it, which means that it is the currency that sort of pegs all the other currencies. And everybody trades, almost everybody trades with U.S. dollars. There's some effort to try and break away from that of late. But even so, in spite of that, and in spite of the recent downgrading, it's still the world reserve currency. And so that gives the people who create that currency, meaning the United States Treasury and the Federal Reserve System, it gives them a unique advantage over other nations, because everybody's still got to use our money, more or less. No matter how worthless it is, they're stuck with it. So we've had a free ride for a long time, and we've been spared the effect of this inevitability that we're talking about, but it's still coming.
Just another way to explain that is that it gives us there's a buffer of an established monetary base existing in the world into which we can inflate with the protection of that buffer. In other words, the Fed can create a lot of trillions of dollars because there are so many billions and trillions in circulation. Whereas a smaller country, if it created even a couple of trillion, it would have hyperinflated the currency, right?
Yes, exactly right. Yeah, there's such a thing as the euro dollars, they call it. The fact that other nations around the world are anxious to acquire U.S. dollars to carry on their own financial transactions because they can't use their own money for that. You take the Zimbabwe experience, for example. Where a little kid goes to the store to buy some groceries for his mother, a bag of groceries, and he's got an armload of $1 trillion Zimbabwe notes, an armload of them.
Yeah.
And in a nation like that, you cannot conduct any meaningful economic transactions in terms of Zimbabwe dollars. So what do you use? You use American dollars. And that's true in a lot of countries around the world. And so there's always been a demand for American dollars because the local currencies of these other countries are even worse. As you say, we can create trillions and trillions, and if they all stayed within our borders, we'd feel the impact immediately. But the fact that they are feathered out around the world, we are spared the immediate impact of that.
Let's try to get a sense of the idea of how much money is actually being created and flooded into the system, because the first Wall Street bailout began in the fall of 2008. That was under Bush, right? And then when Obama came into office, then things went, it was like a carnival with new money creation. Can you give us a sense of what is really happening in this financial blowout that we're seeing?
Well, yes, I don't know whether putting numbers on it means anything anymore because
you're right.
What is a trillion, I don't know. Nobody has any idea. $1 trillion is so vast, and then $3 trillion and $17 trillion is so vast that it becomes meaningless. There's no way in the world that amount of debt can ever be repaid. Let's just get a handle on that. It's a myth to think that is debt, because it's not. That will never be repaid. It cannot ever be repaid, except of course in one way, which is where we're headed. So let's deal with that. How can such big debts be repaid? And the answer is by reducing the value of the dollar to nothing. Then you can repay them with nothing. And that's sort of a hyperbole way of saying it. But supposing a dollar eventually becomes worth 1/1,000,000th of a penny, then you can pay off the $1 trillion debts with a reasonable amount of value because the dollar itself has become so worthless. And that's how they intend to pay off this debt. It'll be a bookkeeping entry, and the net result is that the debt will be paid by the common man. It won't be paid by the people who borrowed it. It won't be paid by the banks or the corporations that borrowed it and used it when it still had purchasing power. No, they will not pay it off because the system will collapse. The currency will be reissued. It'll be reevaluated. It will be repudiated, and a whole new currency takes its place. And at that point, the purchase price of everything just goes through the ceiling, and people who still have their savings or anything in terms of dollars are wiped out. It happens, as you say, over and over again in history, and that's where we're headed. So when these people talk about, we must raise the debt ceiling, otherwise we're going to... repudiate it or whatever, they're going to repudiate it anyway, except they're either going to repudiate the debt by declaring that we're not going to, pay off any of the bondholders anymore. That would be terrible, they say. Or we're going to repudiate the debt by just stealing it from all the citizens of the United States. And that's not so terrible, apparently, because that's what they decided to do.
Yeah, in every one of these cases, it seems like the governments of the world always loot the economy, and ultimately it becomes a great transfer of wealth from the working class to the wealthy elite bankers, right?
Exactly. That's what's happening. This is legalized plunder.
Now, what does it actually look like, though? A lot of people, really, they're not living in reality. You know this very well. They're living in their little worlds of fictional constructs that have been handed to them by the media and the government and the president. and they don't get it yet what this is really going to look like. Do you have a sense of, for example, how did it happen in Zimbabwe? Was it an accelerating hyperinflation that took place over a period of months? Or what was there one specific day that the government announced you have to trade in your currency for a new currency? What does it look like on the street? I mean, what actually happens in this process?
In all honesty, I don't know the timetable in Zimbabwe, but I do know the pretty good handle of the timetable in Argentina and in Germany. And it was a parabolic curve. In other words, it started slow. I just gradually kept increasing and increasing, and the rate kept increasing. And it seemed like, you hit a certain point about two-thirds up a parabolic curve, and all of a sudden, even though the process is continuing as before, the angle is now so steep that it looks like it's vertical, in fact, becomes vertical very quickly. So I remember reading and hearing some conversations from people years ago that lived through the German experience, and they said that they were managing okay, they were coping with inflation, and then just like almost one day, it seemed to them, that they realized they were in hyperinflation. And it was runaway, almost overnight, it's how they felt anyway. Hmm. And I think that's how it always happens. It probably happened that way in Zimbabwe too, but I just don't know the timetable on that. So usually there's not one event because this is an ongoing process, you see.
Sure. But during this entire time, the government, or the Fed in this case, is creating more money. The Treasury is dumping that into the money supply. I mean, people are still getting their government checks, let's say. What is it, 80 million checks? Government checks go out a month to people, and the numbers on your checks, Social Security, veterans benefits, whatever, the numbers are still the same, but those numbers just don't mean as much with each increasing check that you get. It's increasingly worthless, right?
That's exactly the formula. I remember reading somebody who lived in the German hyperinflation and collapse of the Deutsche Mark. They had their life savings in an insurance policy. And I've forgotten the amount, but let's just say in today's value, let's call it, say $500,000, their life savings, an insurance policy, and they were planning to retire on that. And when it came to retirement age, in order to collect it from the insurance company, the postage stamp on the application form cost as much as what they got for their life savings.
Oh, my.
So, you see, this is what we're talking about. They got their $500,000, all right. Yeah, they weren't cheated out of that. It's just that a postage stamp now costs $500,000. Well, so that's how it works.
This concept of the erosion of the value of the currency is difficult for a lot of mainstream people to grasp. I don't know if it's just that public education doesn't teach math anymore, or just an unwillingness to face reality. I don't know, but people don't seem to get it, and this leads to the issue that so many people are going to be shocked, surprised, I mean, absolutely angry that the value of their money is disappearing. What do you think, Ed, is going to be the reaction among the uninformed masses, when they begin to realize what's happening?
Well, I know what's going to happen. It's the same thing that we see happening now in other countries. Where people are losing their entitlements. They think they're entitled to certain things, government benefits, retirement programs. They've been relying on government for all of this for so many years. They consider that to be, like a gift from God if they're entitled to it. They don't realize that the governments are really, in many cases, nothing but professional plunderers. And but in any event, when it finally comes to the point where they realize that they've been plundered and they're not getting what they thought they were supposed to get, they hit the streets and there's violence and there's civil unrest and then there's martial law and then that's the end of freedom. And we know that that is coming because the government has told us so. In a way, they've been planning for it. It doesn't take much just reading of the newspaper in the last 5-8 years. Increasingly, you read stories about how local police departments and state police agencies are preparing for massive civil unrest here in the United States. They're preparing for it. They have planned on it. They understand these forces that we're talking about. They know that the day is coming when they're going to have to control a very unruly population who are in the streets demanding their welfare, demanding their food stamps, demanding their place to live, their health care benefits, and so forth. And they're going to have to subdue these people and possibly send them to camps.
FEMA camps.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, how does this work, though? How does law enforcement get paid? How does military get paid by the government during this time? Are they just given checks with lots and lots of zeros at the? I mean, how does the government? Maybe this is too specific, but I'm just curious. How does
It's a good question. The answer has to be, and I don't really know. That's the reason I'm stumbling on this. I've never looked at that part. But how does any totalitarian regime pay the soldiers and the police and the agents that it has? It must pay them with money, but it also gives them privileges. It gives them. I know during the Soviet Union era, I talked to a lot of people that came out of there, and they said that if you were up in the ranks, if you were in the party, or if you were in the military, you had special passes. You could get food. You could go into certain depots that let you in where you could load up on food, where everybody else was starving, you see. And
right.
they had special commissaries where they could purchase things. They had selections of food and goods that other people did not have access to. And that was one of the reasons that so many people wanted to be in the Communist Party, because it gave them privileges, not just money, but other privileges as well. So I don't know. It probably works something like that in every country. I don't see why it would be any different here.
Yeah, like maybe they get paid in vouchers for government cheese or something.
Whatever, yeah. like that. And also they know that they're going to have a roof over their head, because they're in the military, and they're going to have a certain amount of security if they follow orders.
Sure, right. And we know that soldiers will do just about anything they're ordered to do. Even cops will do anything. They'll torture people, take away their rights, ransack their homes.
Yeah, it's pathetic, but it's true. I think it's human nature. We were shocked when we saw that happen in Nazi Germany. We couldn't believe that the Nazi soldiers in these concentration camps would say, well, we were just following orders, you know.
Right.
But now we see it here as well.
Now, you mentioned that there were shortages in other countries. That brings up the question here. As prices begin to really hyperinflate in the marketplace, especially on food, there will be a public outcry for government to enact price controls, right? It always happens. And so if the government does that, then we're going to see an immediate shortage, like empty shelves.
Yes. And that's where the privileged ones will have the advantage, because they'll have the coupons. They'll have the books, you know. They'll have the status, the priorities. And everybody will want to scramble for favored position in the government hierarchy. And you know you've reached the end when that happens.
Indeed. By the way, before we continue, do you want to give out your web address or where people can learn more if they want to hear more from you?
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate that. We have several websites. Our think tank website, we like to call it, is called freedomforceinternational.org. It's where we don't have anything to sell there. We just have ideas and plans and concepts for how to solve this problem, how to get organized, how to build a better future, and all of that. So anybody that wants to participate in this long view of history and become part of the solution and not just complain about things, that's where you want to come, to freedomforceinternational.org. But then we have a commercial site where we sell books and audio recordings and DVDs and that kind of thing. And I have about 100 different items there. My books are among them, but we have a lot of other things, including your material, too, I might add, Mike.
That's right.
And so they could come to realityzone.com. So there are the two of them.
And your books are available, too, on Amazon. You have The Creature from Jekyll Island, and you have The Cure. What's the
vitamin? Well, we have one. The one on cancer is called World Without Cancer.
There we go.
Uh-huh.
Any other books you want to mention?
Well, let's see. We have a lot of DVDs. I guess just come on onto the website. I think you're going to like them all. We're pretty controversial in the sense that we're upstream. The kind of material that we deal with is not going to be found on the mainstream media. And we get into a lot of mischief.
That's great. Yeah, our listeners and readers love to be informed, and they are going to really love your website. And just for those listening, so you know, Ed Griffin was one of the powerful influencing figures in my own education about freedom and health. And Ed, you continue to be a very powerful and courageous voice out there for truth and liberty. And that's what's going to pull us out of this thing. I mean, for those who survive it, you know, and because not everybody's going to make it through this future here, but to get to the other side, we've got to rebuild a society based on liberty and true justice and true law, not this made-up stuff that the White House keeps doing.
Yeah, you're quite right. And it's when we use the word law, that's a wonderful word, and it's also a dangerous word, isn't it? Because we keep hearing guys like George Bush, when he was speaking at the UN, he'd say, well, what we must build now is a new world order based on the rule of law. And it just sounded so good. I was thinking to myself, yeah, what kind of law, George? What kind? That's the question we need to ask. I mean, Adolf Hitler had a lot of laws, and the Soviet Union was based on the rule of law, and Mao Zedong had the rule of law, and the guys in Washington today are passing laws, 24/7. That's what they have in mind. And we need to think in terms of what kind of law.
That's a really good point. Let me ask you along those lines, because I know that your beliefs as well as mine, we believe that human rights and dignity and law stems from what we might call natural law. That, in other words, we're born with rights and freedoms. We're not granted those by a government that dominates over us.
Exactly.
How would you describe it?
Well, that's one of the things that we spend a lot of time addressing there at Freedom Force International, is an understanding of this basic principle, because if we're going to build a better world, we better be very clear on this. Otherwise, we're just going to overthrow one tyranny and replace it with another one just like it. And that's what happens so often in history. And so we want people to think in terms of the difference between positive law and negative law. Our collectivist opponents believe in positive law. They believe that it is the function of government to create things, to control things, to direct things, to be the great organizer and leader of society. Well, you want food? Well, the government will create the food or distribute the food. Whatever you want, the government will do it for you or see that it happens better than if you did it yourself. So the collectivist mentality is that the government will be the leader and do everything that's positive that we want. And of course, if the government can do everything you want, it can prevent you from doing anything you want as well. If it gives you everything you want, it can take from you everything you have, and so forth. The other kind of law, and that's what we believe in, is the negative law or the defensive law. We believe that the only justification for coercion, the use of force against your fellow human being, the only justification for that is in the defense of life, liberty, and property. Nothing more. Stop right there. And if the purpose of the state was simply to protect the citizens, to protect their lives, their liberty, and their property, it would be a utopia. And then everything else, all the positive aspects of society, would be up to the individual acting in freedom. And it would happen much better than under a collectivist system. And, of course, we'd be free besides.
Well said. And that contrasts the key differences in belief. I've sometimes described that as liberty lovers versus the nanny state worshipers.
The control freaks.
The control freaks, right. And they literally believe, and there are many, sometimes they're in the majority, they literally believe that individuals have no place to determine, to make their own decisions or determine their own fate in life. Maybe not fate, I mean outcome. And that the government must direct every little aspect of their lives, including what they eat, their health care, how they save money through forced Social Security confiscation, and so on. You're listening to the Health Ranger Report on Natural News Radio. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
Do you know someone who can benefit from this radio program? You can find the complete archives of this show and hundreds of others at naturalnewsradio.com. Just send your friend that link, naturalnewsradio.com, where they will find truly amazing interviews and information that simply isn't published anywhere else. In the Natural News Radio archives, you'll find interviews with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Senator Rand Paul, Governor Jesse Ventura, Suzanne Summers, alternative cancer doctors, nutrition experts, preparedness experts, and a wealth of others. And it's all free. Listen in real time at naturalnewsradio.com or download the MP3 archive files anytime you want to listen on your phone, mobile devices, or personal computer. When you want articles on these topics, check out naturalnews.com with over 35,000 article pages on nutrition, natural cures, health freedom, and much more. It's all part of the Natural News Network. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. In uncertain times, you need gear you can count on. That's why I teamed up with Daniel Vitalis to launch SupplySource.com. It's a new online retailer offering extremely durable gear for emergency preparedness and long-term survival. Everything we offer survives my daily use test on a ranch in Texas, plus Daniel's outdoor endurance test in the rugged wilderness of Maine. Most of the stuff we test ends up in a pile of trash because it breaks. The stuff that doesn't break, we stock it on SupplySource.com. To get the site started, we've launched it with a line of rugged, reliable, waterproof LED flashlights, now chosen by military and law enforcement everywhere. And we'll soon be adding a whole new brand of emergency water filters, family defense gear, and urban survival tools. When you want your gear to really work, get it from SupplySource.com. Have you ever wanted to learn where you can get free food and medicine from the plants growing around your neighborhood? Or how to turn your own backyard into a food production center? Or even how to reverse cancers using the latest groundbreaking research in alternative cancer therapies? You can learn all this and more from webseed.com. It's sort of like Netflix, but it's for documentaries and how-to courses on natural health, food production, self-reliance, and other life-saving topics. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and I created WebSeed so that listeners like you could get instant streaming access to truly groundbreaking instructional courses. Our new program called Vaccines Armed and Dangerous exposes the total fraud of modern vaccine quackery, and our Survival course teaches emergency preparedness, including skills like how to build your own emergency water filter. Explore over 100 valuable courses and documentaries right now at WEBSEED.com.
Everything, every aspect of human activity they believe should be controlled by the state. And of course, sort of lurking behind that assumption is the idea that they themselves are going to be running the state, that they're the ones be making the decision, or at least having some very powerful input to it. So they feel that they're a little smarter than the other people, that the average person is too darn dumb to know what's good for him, and so that only we, the enlightened ones, we who have been to school, we have, you know, read the books and so forth, we're the ones that should make these decisions for those poor people out there. And it's our obligation to mankind to rule.
Right. It reminds
really,
me.
They really believe that. They really believe that.
Truly, they do.
Yeah.
They do. I remember there were Nobel Prizes in mathematics or statistics handed out to some of the people who created the investment theories behind long-term capital management, LTCM, which, of course, too big to fail, was one of the earlier bailouts of a failed institution. But, you know, these scientists thought they were so smart and so smug that they had it all figured out. We know how to control the economy. We're in charge, you know, Greenspan and everybody else, Paulson, Geithner, Bernanke, and so on. They are. They live with a sense of arrogance that is just almost inhuman. It's incredible.
Yeah. And yet it's easy to understand that, you know, you go through school and you begin to think, gosh, I'm sure glad I'm privileged that I had a chance to go to school. And I may not be smarter than everybody else, but I'm lucky that I got a good education. So now I know more than everybody else, especially my parents, you know, well, they don't know anything. And so you go through this educational process, and it seems like the more higher education a person gets, the more they begin to believe this thing that they really are privileged and that they are smarter, or at least more informed, more wise, and it comes out with this heady whine. They just want to control society because they feel that they're going to be so good at it.
That's true. What about on the other side, the people out there who almost bow down before these dictatorial bureaucrats? Do you think, Ed, that there's something almost hardwired into the brains of many people that it's like they must look for someone else to direct their lives?
Mike, that's a really poignant question. I have thought about that a lot over the years, and I have come to the conclusion that there is something hardwired in most of our minds to that effect. We all have a tendency to follow the herd. There's a herd instinct in Homo sapiens. Now, I think it's stronger in some people than in others, but I think we all have it. And we all instinctively, we get into a group of people, and it doesn't take long. You've seen this at cocktail parties. It doesn't take long before you can spot who is the leading the herd there, who is the dominant person, or maybe two dominant people in a group. And everybody else seems to be content to step aside and let them be the dominant people. Sometimes you see a little conflict as two struggle for total dominance. That gets to be really interesting. But most of the time that doesn't happen. And then when that dominant person leaves the room, doesn't take long before somebody else steps forward, and now they're the dominant one. You just see that. You see that in the animal kingdom, and I think there's a certain element in the human mind that does that too. So we want leaders, and we instinctively, you know, seek them out and follow them. There are always, I think, 3% or in that range of the population that have a sort of an instinct for leadership. And it's not that they want to control. It's just that they have that personality trait, and that makes them a natural leader. And I don't know whether that's good or bad. I think that's reality. You see it in school. Everybody has a tribal instinct that develops real fast in school. You go and you root for your team against the team for the school on the other side of town, and sometimes that can be a very fierce conflict. You know, our team against their team. It's just a team, for God's sake. but we, you know, as children, we respond to groups of friends, and then we have gangs, and then we've got neighborhoods and communities, this community versus this nation versus that nation. So we got this tribal instinct too, which I think is there in us, partly because it has a survival value. Yeah. You know, if you fall away from the group and you're on your own, you'll be picked off by a predator. We see that in the animal kingdom, where they travel in herds just to protect the old and the weak and the young.
Well, that makes a lot of sense in that context of pre-civilization, we might say. But I think, as you're hinting, some of these traits of Homo sapiens can be a great disservice in a modern civilization. Do you think that we, as a species now, that we are even qualified to survive? Because sometimes I question, you know, are we really even going to make it for another 1,000 years on this planet without destroying ourselves? What do you think?
I don't know. Boy, that's a scary question. It seems to me that there are so many technological changes being pushed today that bring that question into serious doubt. I mean, they're talking about genetically re-engineering the human race. They're talking about creating a subspecies, consciously creating a human subspecies to act as a servant type of robotoid, and they're actually, you know, discussing how to do this genetically, and then they're having conferences right now on what are the legal implications. Should these robotoids be given the same rights as human beings? I mean, there are people discussing that right now, and
but they don't have enough wage slaves already. What's the deal?
No, they want some more. Anyway, it scares me, and I just I don't know whether the human race is going to survive or not.
Well, I mean, we've covered the genetic contamination of the planet through GMOs, genetic engineering. We've got even NASA admits time is going to come when there's a massive solar flare that basically obliterates everything electronic on the planet as it's hit with this big solar flare. And it's hard to imagine how the nuclear power plants in our world would not go into total meltdown in that kind of a electronic disruption. And we saw that with Fukushima. You know, when the generators fail, the fuel melts down. So, I mean, those are just two quick examples, but I can think of many other examples where the future of human survival is really in question.
Yeah, it's not a very pleasant thought, is it? And unfortunately, there's not much we can do about it. I wish that we had a true free society where issues like this could be discussed openly and could be converted into public policy. But, you know, in the world today, it doesn't make any difference what we think. Those who are advancing this agenda don't really care. They have their own agendas, and public discussion doesn't... Well, first of all, it's not really encouraged.
Yeah.
And secondly, if it were, it wouldn't make any difference.
That's true. That's quite true, and that is very disturbing. And the distractions that are out there, you know, bread and circuses,
yes,
are put in our way to prevent us from understanding or debating the bigger issues, like who has control over the economy. You know, it reminds me, 500 years ago, the institution of control, social control, was the church. Today, the institution of social control is the Fed.
Yeah. Well, you know, the early socialists, as they called themselves then, now I think the word collectivist is a little better word, but the socialists of the last century always wrote about the coming utopia where everything was controlled by people like themselves. And many of them, like H.G. Wells, for example, said that the religion must be replaced by the state, and that the state itself must become the new god, and the worship of the state should become the new religion. And that is the only way, H.G. Wells said, that man can have true relationship to eternity. And these people were dead serious. And you can see that concept today, it's already happened. The state has replaced religion, really, in terms of putting bigger values to the meaning of life and so forth. People, the whole concern today is what's good for society, you know? Whatever yeah. society is. I don't know what society is, but they seem to know, and they define it as they go.
Well, it seems like the best example of H.G. Wells' hopeful description, where I have to say there is a beautiful, wonderful utopia in operation right now where the state is God, is North Korea. I mean, I would love to live in North Korea and be part of that wonderful, beautiful, free society.
Oh, yes.
I mean, look at that.
Incredible, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, there are plenty of places where the state is God, and we're not far from that here.
Yeah, I've seen that, right. I've run into a lot of Obama worshippers that really see him as a saint in the same way that...
The high priest or something like that.
Yes, yes, and he can do no wrong, even though his policies are mirror image of Bush's policies.
Yeah, well, who cares about that? Those are details.
Yeah, true.
Well, anyway, it's pretty pretty negative, isn't it? Pretty pessimistic, these things. But on the positive side, you know, the fact is that there are around the world tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people who are coming to be aware of these issues, and they're networking, they're beginning to, and not all of them, of course, are coming through Freedom Force yet, but we hope that that's the nucleus that will show the way for a better future. And to tell you the truth, Mike, I'm very optimistic, not for the short term, because I think the short term is really dark. You know, people want to know, what are we going to do? How are we going to solve this by next November? You know, they want the whole right. thing wrapped up and solved by next November, which means they want to know who to vote for. They think that a president, some man on a white horse, is going to change all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that that's not going to happen. But I do know that somewhere down the line, probably in a generation or two at the most, this will be turned around. And so if you have the long view of history, and we're putting into place right now the building blocks for the foundation of that new world. And that's very, very encouraging to me.
Well, let's talk about the positive side, because I'm like you, I'm a long-term optimist as well, because I think these ideas of freedom are very infectious and they're spreading. And the internet has given us a new platform from which we have been able to reach a lot of new people that we couldn't reach before, let's say 1994, when there really wasn't an internet. We have a lot of incredible opportunities here. Do you think it's going to be just a division, like a certain group of people who are informed are going to have a better chance at making it through this and then rebuilding a more free society? How do you see it playing out?
I guess the honest answer is that I have a double vision on that. I don't know which way it's going to go, but it can only go one of two ways. Either the whole system collapses, and out of the ashes there's a rebuilt new society, and in which case people with the vision of liberty and the understanding of the value of negative law versus positive law and all that sort of thing, and they become the new leaders and the new builders of society. That's one scenario. And the other is that gradually we are able to go into the power centers of society that exist now and gradually turn them around, take them back, get them out of the hands of collectivists and totalitarians. And in which case, it would be a gradual process, and we could save the essential structure of the system. I don't know which way it's going to go. Maybe, I just don't know. I guess I have to say that again. Who knows? But it's all I do know is that either way, we have to create a lot of new people who understand the essence of freedom and convince them that they have to do something about it other than just learn about it and complain about it. They've got to get out of their homes and go out there where the people are and become active in society so that they can exert influence in the public policy of the nation. Whether it's a gradual transition or a complete rebuild, either way, we need that. So that's where we're focusing as far as Freedom Force is concerned.
Along the way, the ticking time bomb, so to speak, here is the impending financial collapse. That sets a time limit, even though you don't know the exact day, and nor do I. I mean, we don't have crystal balls, but there is a finite period here under which the government as we know it can even function.
Well, as we know it, yes. But the government can function as we have never known it before. And that's pretty scary, because if the public turns to the government to save them from the problems that the government created, which is the scenario that is unfolding now, then what will the government do? It will do exactly what they're expected to do, and that is that they will start to provide food and clothing and shelter and jobs and all the things that people are clamoring for, but in exchange for their freedom. They'll say, okay, get in the truck and go to this camp and live in that barracks and do as you're told, and yeah, we'll do all those things for you. Uh-huh. And so we will wind up in a completely totalitarian system, the kind of America we've never known before. And that is what follows at the tail end of that economic collapse. It's not just poverty, people standing around, you know, cooking weak soup in a pot with their hand out. That's the old vision of, you know, the Depression of the 1930s. No, it's not that at all. This is a new and something we've never seen before.
And isn't it likely that we'll also see a lot of government confiscation, not just of the precious metals, but possibly of private bank accounts, certainly retirement accounts, maybe even private property such as land or agricultural land?
Well, yes, and I don't know how to say this. Perhaps the best way to sum it up, in my view at least, it's not to say that it's going to be that way, but it seems to me that the essence of collectivism, which is what's coming out of all of this, is the militarization of all society. If you imagine that what it's like in the army. Okay, you go into the army, you give up your personal freedom, you're told what to do, you're given rank, you're given pay, your food and shelter and health care, and you do what you are told. And if you don't, you're in the brig, or you go to the firing squad. And you work your way up the rank. You start as maybe at the bottom, and you get rank, or maybe you go in as an officer. In any event, everybody's trying to move up to get higher rank so that they can wear something on their shirts or their caps to be recognized as having senior authority over other people. Uh-huh. And it's kind of a beehive society. And if you can picture the whole world being that way, then I think you get an idea of where we're headed if we don't turn this thing around.
Pretty scary scenario there. It's hard to stay positive sometimes when considering the patterns of history and what's headed our way.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to stay positive, but that's what we're talking about, and that's our mission, is to be realistic and not just try and pump a lot of sunshine out there to cheer people up, but to cause them to be realistic. Because if we don't understand what the problem really is, we're surely not going to solve it. So we think we understand what it is, and it's dark, it's dank, and going to require a lot of work, and it's going to be a lot of pain and suffering. But the big thing is, but we can come out the other end of it, and we'll come out very well.
It seems like it is a natural human tendency for a group of small, self-selected elite to always seek to exercise dominance over the masses.
Yes.
And it is only in these extraordinary circumstances, such as the founding of this nation and the Bill of Rights, that tendency is kept in check.
Yes. That was quite a rare thing in history, where that trend was completely reversed. I marvel at that. Often when I think that at the end of the American Revolution, the average person in America was perfectly content with royalty. They had no problem with monarchy at all. They just didn't like King George. They thought he was a bad man. He was cruel. He was unfair, unjust, and so forth. So they just wanted to get rid of him, and they wanted George Washington to be their new king.
That's true. And he refused, right?
And he refused. Can you imagine that? I mean, here people were clamoring for a king. They didn't understand that the problem was concentration of power. They didn't understand all of the concepts that Jefferson and Washington and Adams and all the others were talking about. They didn't understand it. How fortunate we were that we had just this handful of greatly enlightened men who were able to take charge of the country and set it on an entirely different course.
Yeah, what an amazing precedent in history, and it makes you wonder what might be next in the creation of free societies by aware individuals, men and women, who can take part of in the future. I mean, how can we do better than the Constitution and the Bill of Rights? Can we?
Well, we have to. I think it was a fantastic beta model. I think considering that nothing like that had ever been done before, the fact that it survived for a little over 100 years is amazing, but it wasn't perfect because obviously it didn't hold the ship on its course.
Yeah.
It had some weaknesses, and now we know what they were. First of all, I believe, let me put it this way, I've come to a certain conclusions about what the weaknesses of the Constitution were, and I hate to even say that, because some people say, how dare you question the Constitution? Well, as a beta model, I thought it was fantastic, but that's all it was. Now it's our turn. It's our turn now to find out what went wrong, and the next model is ours, and we'll make it better. I think that one of the big problems with the American form of government and the Constitution is that the Founding Fathers made a mistake in the selection of one word. They said, what kind of a government are we going to create? And they used the word government. I thought about that long and hard, and I said, you know what? What's the purpose of government? It's to govern. Oh, wait a minute. There's the problem right there. What they created, actually, was not a government at all. What they created with the Constitution was a protectorate. Now, we're back to that concept of positive versus negative law again. You see, they chose the old word from the old world. They always had governments in Europe, so now they're going to create a new, and then they stumbled and used the word government. Had they said, we now create a protectorate from that point forward, everybody that used the word would have to think, what's the difference between a protectorate and a government? And the word itself is a magnificent a lesson to protect, not to provide. So anyway, I think that was one of the mistakes, and I think when we get a chance to redo this, we'll make sure that in the new document, it's very clear that the purpose of the state is to protect and not to lead or provide.
That is a really outstanding observation, a good point. I hope that that becomes part of the discussion, that we'll have an opportunity to even have that discussion in the future. I mean, it's hard to imagine under what circumstances a new Congress might convene and begin working on new. I mean, they would instantly be charged with treason, just as our founding fathers were
yes.
considered.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine, but you know, Mike, I can assure you that it will happen somewhere and sometime, and what we're doing today will hopefully impact on the outcome of that event.
Indeed, very much so. Well, Ed, I want to thank you for taking the time to share your thoughts with us.
Well, it's my pleasure, Mike. It's a pleasure to talk to you, and I know you have a very active audience, and their minds are open to this sort of thing, and so I'm really glad to share it with you and your friends.
Well, it's been my great enjoyment here speaking with you. I hope to talk to you more because there's so much happening out there, and things are accelerating. The public is really beginning to be open to some ideas that maybe 2 years ago they thought were completely fringe or conspiracy or whatever. But now they're like, hey, wait a minute, things are happening. How do we make sense of this? And that's where they turn to people like you.
Well, keep up the good word, Mike, and we'll collaborate and we'll make it happen.
That sounds great. You know how product companies are always telling you that their poisonous, toxic products are really good for you? Remember Big Tobacco? Well, it's just the same today with Big Ag and Monsanto and GMO seeds. They talk about it's all high-tech agriculture and it's great for the planet and it's going to feed more people. They brag about how good it is for you. Well, I want to show you this to give you some context for the way these companies and these industries lie to you. Go back to the 1960s. And you have this ad for Winston Cigarettes sponsored by or created by the Flintstones. So I'm going to show you this video of the Flintstones promoting these cigarettes, but also want you to realize that the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, for several decades promoted Camels as cigarettes. They said that more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette, and they used this false authority of doctors and the medical journal to try to say that Camels are great for your health, and smoking is great for your health. In fact, it was the American Medical Association that said smoking cigarettes is good for your teeth, that it's good for your brain, it helps you mentally focus, that it's just good for your health and gives you a better life. Now, of course, today we know that's an absurd idea. Cigarettes give you cancer. Cigarettes give you heart disease. Now, they destroy your health. But, you know, that didn't stop these companies and even these medical institutions from promoting them and making money while the public was killing themselves with these products. Now, nothing has really changed. I mean, here it is 2012, and we're still being marketed all these products by Procter & Gamble and these personal care products and all these pesticides and food additives and, you know, stuff at the grocery store that's just loaded with cancer-causing chemicals and GMOs, too. We're being marketed all this stuff, and we're being told by authorities and celebrities, oh, this is great for you. Eat this. You know, cook with that. Spray this on your lawn, and your life will be better. Well, folks, it's all a lie, all right? It's all disinfo and propaganda to convince you to buy products that are actually ruining your health and ruining your life and turning you into a lifelong medical slave so that the system makes more money off of you as a diseased individual rather than a healthy individual. So keep that in mind as you watch this commercial with the Flintstones promoting Winston cigarettes. Check it out.
You work hard, don't they, Barney?
Yeah? I hate to see them work so hard.
Yeah, me too.
Let's go around back.
Well, we can't see them.
Gee, Gee, we ought to do something, Fred.
Okay. How's about taking a nap?
I got a better idea. Let's take a Winston break.
That's it. Winston is the one filter cigarette that delivers flavor 20 times a pack. Winston's got that filter blend.
Yeah, Fred. Filter blend makes the big taste difference, and only Winston has it up front where it counts. Here, ahead of the pure white filter. Winston packs rich tobaccos specially selected and specially processed for good flavor in filter smoking.
Yeah, Barney, Winston tastes good like a cigarette should.